So the title of the talk is The Five Niyamas and the Evolution of the Human Brain. So first thing I'll say is that if you read Sangharakshita, you'll realise how much he's been influenced by the English Romantic poets. Poets like Blake, Shelley, Wordsworth, Keats, Coleridge. Poets who were alive and writing at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century. This was a group of poets very much involved with exploring and enjoying nature, very much worried at the consequences of the early phases of the Industrial Revolution. They were filled with ideas springing from the French Revolution, and they very much questioned religion. And they were fascinated with science. There's a very well-known biographer of the English Romantic poets, a man called Richard Holmes. And he's recently written about this fascination with science in a book called The Age of Wonder. It's about how that particular period of time filled people with fascination about discovery, about exploration, and about the mystery and wonder that the world of science was opening up at the start of the 19th century. So, if poetry is a strong feature of Sangharakshita's writings about Buddhism, then science, on the face of it, features less strongly. But there is one idea in science that's been a key feature of Sangharakshita's take on Buddhism, and that idea is evolution. It was the taped talks by Sangharakshita on the theme of evolution and Buddhism that captured my imagination and cemented my interest in Buddhism in the mid-1990s. I'm not a scientist, but I love reading popular science books. I love reading science fiction. And evolution was and is one of my favourite subjects for reading. So Sangharakshita hooked me into Buddhism through evolution. And more recently, I've again felt some of that sense of wonder and fascination with science and evolution as I've been reading some of the many new books on the discoveries about the workings of the human brain. One scientist estimates that the knowledge of the brain has doubled in the last 20 years. There's a palpable sense of excitement, a real sense of excitement in the field of neuroscience, in the science of the brain. So I've been reading a lot about the brain and wondering whether I can make some sense of that reading in relation to Buddhist theory and practice. And as I've pondered how to do this, I've realised that Sangharakshita has given me a framework in which to try to explore and explain the relevance of these discoveries in the science of the brain. And this framework has two parts. The first part is the teaching of Pratityat Samuppada, dependent arising or conditionality, and in particular Sangharakshita's elaboration of this teaching through his explanation of the five niyamas or levels of conditionality. This is the five levels of conditionality, and I'll explain them in a minute. The second part of the framework that Sangharakshita has given me involves relating the story of the human brain to our everyday life as Buddhists through Sangharakshita's system of meditation, or more broadly, as I'd like to call it tonight, his system of practice. Because his system of meditation doesn't just apply to sitting meditation, it applies to every aspect of our everyday life. So I'm going to start with Pratityat Samuppada, the core teaching of the Buddha. Conditionality, dependent co-arising, dependent origination. These are some of the ways that it's translated into English. And my favourite formulation of it is the Buddha's teaching, which goes like this. This being that becomes, with the arising of this that arises. This not being that does not become, with the ceasing of this that ceases. Now, what's this saying? It's saying a great deal. It's saying that there is no such thing as a thing. Everything, in fact, is a process coming into being and going out of being in dependence upon conditions. And everything or every process is itself part of the conditioning affecting other things or processes. Nothing is fixed, nothing is separate, everything changes. So reality, it's saying, is a flow of ever-changing conditioned processes coming into and going out of being. And this process of dependent co-arising, of conditionality, has a regularity or has patterns that apply to everything in the universe, including us and our minds and our brains. Now, the Buddha himself didn't fully elaborate these patterns when he was alive. But after he died, there emerged what's called a commentarial tradition, a tradition of commentators who expanded or reformulated in different ways the Buddha's teachings. And in particular, they explored and formulated the patterns of conditionality. And this exploration resulted in a system known as the five niyamas, or levels of conditionality. And this system of five levels of conditionality has become a key part of Sangharakshita's approach to the Dharma. He's made more of it, I think, than any other modern Buddhist. And the five levels of conditionality, or the five niyamas, are firstly the physical inorganic, known as the uttu niyama. Secondly, the physical organic, known as the bija niyama. Then the third level is the instinctive mental order, which is known as the mana or the chitta niyama. And then the fourth level is the volitional mental order, known as the kama or karma niyama. And finally, fifthly, there's the transcendental order of conditionality, the dhamma or dharma niyama. So I want to just look at these in more detail. The first level of conditionality, the physical inorganic, is basically all of the physical laws of the universe. And this covers the evolution of the universe from the moment of the Big Bang to the formation of stars, to the formation of the solar system and the planets, including our own. It covers gravity, it covers the laws of chemistry, it covers geology, it covers plate tectonics, the forces that create earthquakes, that create tsunamis, tidal waves, and that create volcanic ash that disturbs flights across Europe, as it's done today. All this is part of the physical inorganic level of conditionality. The second level of conditionality, the physical organic, is the point at which simple cell and plant life appears. So this covers things like viruses, what we in England call the swine flu. I think you call it the new flu, do you? Or do you call it swine flu as well? I think it's the new flu here, because when I went to get my vaccination against swine flu here in Sweden, it didn't say swine flu, it said new flu. And I thought, well, the Swedes are very conscious of not being offensive to animals, much more than the English are. So the second level of conditionality, the physical organic, covers simple cell and plant life. The third level of conditionality, the instinctive mental order, covers instinctive elements of animal life, basic survival instincts that are there in animals, whether to fight or flee, the urge to eat and drink, and so on. This is the instinctive mental order level of conditionality. The fourth level, the kamma or karma level, the volitional mental order, is the human realm. It's our realm. It's the realm of self-awareness. It's the realm of ethical choice. We can make choices about our behavior. And the final level of conditionality, the fifth level, the Dhamma or transcendental order of conditionality, if you like, is the life of a Buddha. Subhuti has recently defined the Dhamma Nyima or the Dharma Nyima as the point where the self-aware individual makes contact with a pattern of conditioned arising that transcends the individual. In other words, it has this idea that something in us can contact an order of conditionality that goes beyond the individual, that transcends the individual. That's the Dhamma or Dharma Nyima. Now, we as human beings participate in all five niyamas or levels of conditionality. We're made up of basic physical inorganic elements. We consist of physical organic processes. We have instincts, and we have self-awareness, and we can make choices about our ethical behavior. And perhaps we can contact and become part of the Dhamma Nyima. So all of evolution, from the Big Bang through to the Buddha, is covered by the five levels of conditionality, or the five niyamas. And during the rest of this talk, I'm going to focus mostly on the third and fourth levels of conditionality, on the instinctive mental order and on the volitional mental order. And I'm going to be looking at these through an examination of the evolution of the human brain. I'm not forgetting the fifth level, the transcendental order. This is very, very important, and I'll come back to this. In some ways, you might say it's the most important level of conditionality. So I'm going to be talking about the brain. And I'm using the word brain as a shorthand for the 1.5 kilograms of tofu-like substance that sits between our ears. Really nice description, that. Tofu-like substance. This is a description by one neuroscientist who's also a Buddhist. It means that, and it also includes the body's nervous system and the complex arrangements of interrelated neurons and electrochemical processes that link the brain with the rest of the body. So let's look first at this instinctive mental order of conditionality, the third level of conditionality. And this covers the instinctive patterns of conditioned arising that we have inherited through evolution. Some of what goes on at this level is vital, but is unconscious. It covers the processes that keep us breathing, keep the heart beating, and keep other basic bodily functions going. But there's lots more than that to the brain. One way of looking at the brain and helping us to see the different aspects of the brain in evolutionary terms is to use a model which is known as the, I think it's pronounced, triune brain, which basically means the three-part brain, or the three-in-one brain. The three-part brain, I think, is probably the best description. Now, I must emphasize that some scientists argue that this model is a vast oversimplification, and it's not correct in all its details of how the brain works. But for us non-scientists, and certainly for myself, and certainly in reading that I've done in popular science, this three-part brain model is nevertheless a useful way at looking at the functions and the evolution of the brain. So in this three-part brain, the first part is what's called the reptilian brain, the brain that comes from the period of reptiles. This is representing in a part of the brain, the central part, called the brain stem. And this controls muscles, balance, breathing, heartbeat, and instinctual survival behaviours. And the second part of the brain is known as, well, technically, I think it's pronounced paleomammalian brain. It's the old mammal brain. And this comprises an area of the brain known as the limbic system. It's the area of the brain where you find the source of emotions and instincts. And then the third part of the brain is the neomammalian brain, the new mammal brain, the neocortex. And this is found in the brain of higher mammals like us. And it's responsible for higher order thinking and skills and reasoning and speech and awareness. Now, you can actually visually represent this model, this three-part model of the brain, using your arm and your hand. Basically, if you think of the arm, if you lift the arm here as the spine, as you come into the hand, through the centre of the hand, it becomes the brain stem. If you fold the thumb across, that represents the limbic system. So in the middle, the brain stem is the reptilian brain. Fold the thumb across, that's the limbic system controlling emotions and instincts. That's the old mammal brain. And then if you fold the fingers across the top of the thumb and down, that represents the new mammal brain, the cortex, the neocortex, where we find higher order thinking and reasoning taking place. So the shape of our brain, if you look at a model of the brain, that's what you very roughly see. And you can represent it using the arm and the hand. And it represents, if you like, the evolution of the brain. Now, bear in mind, this is a very simple model, a fairly crude model, and it doesn't show anything like the true complexity of the interrelationships between the different parts of the brain. The brain, it said, is the most complex object known to science. Inside the brain, there are 100 billion neurons, and each neuron can either be switched on or off. So the total number of states, of possible states of the brain, is the total number of possible combinations of 100 billion neurons being switched on or off. To put this in perspective, it's believed that the total number of particles in the universe is a number that's 1 followed by 80 zeros, 800. The total number of possible combinations in the brain is 1 followed by 1 million zeros. A very big number. I mean, it's beyond imagination, I think. It's a very Mahayana-like number. But it's a scientifically based number, apparently. It's a very big number. So the brain is enormously complex, and the interrelationships between the different parts of the brain is much more complex than I can properly explain tonight. I don't have the ability to do it. I'm not a neuroscientist, but I have some idea about it. So let's return then to this instinctive mental order, this third level of conditionality, and its presence in the human brain. And when we look within the human brain and observe people's behaviour, what we can see is that there are two opposite inherited patterns of instinctive behaviour embedded or hardwired into the brain. The first evolutionary pattern that's embedded in the brain we might think of as negative. And this because our evolutionary ancestors were extremely easily activated into states of greed or of hatred. They had to have this easy activation into states of greed or hatred in order to survive. The greater value to survival came from negativity. Without hatred, no survival. Act first, think later. We are finely tuned in our brain to the unpleasant. If we're too much inclined to the pleasant, then we don't notice danger and we get eaten. That's what happened in evolutionary terms. So there's good, understandable reasons why negativity, greed and hatred is hardwired into the brain. But there's just as there's a strong negative behavioural inheritance in our brain that's reflected in this instinctive mental order, there's also a more positive evolutionary inheritance in this third level of conditionality. Contained within the brain are patterns that are more concerned with social abilities. We can argue that over the last 150 million years, the driving force in the development of the brain is greater social abilities. In particular, we can see, if you like, in the archaeology of the brain, three particular sets of stimulus that were given in evolutionary terms and that remain within the brain. The first stimulus happened about 150 million years ago with the appearance of birds and mammals. Before that, there were reptiles and fish, and reptiles and fish don't care for their young. Birds and mammals do care for their young. So areas of the brain began to develop for cooperation and care. If you have young, you have to have cooperation and care. And the brain gets bigger. The second stimulus occurred with the appearance of the primates, of apes and monkeys and so on, about 80 million years ago. And here we have now the emergence of more complex relationships, greater sociability in groups, behaviours like grooming and touching, and the brain gets bigger again. And then the third stimulus comes with the appearance of humans. In the last 2.5 million years, apparently, the human brain has tripled in size since our ancestors started to make tools. And most of what's been added to the brain in the last 2.5 million years is used for social, emotional, linguistic and conceptual processes. This is because the more successful hunter-gatherer groups were better at teamwork than other hunter-gatherer groups. And within each individual hunter-gatherer group, the person who best had these abilities of teamwork was more successful at mating. So the fruit of all this is reflected in the brain and is seen in our outward behaviour as altruism, as generosity, as fairness, in our language, in our empathy, in our ability to forgive, and even, you could argue, in the development of morality and religion. You can make an argument that all of these aspects of outward behaviour come from the instinctive mental order. They're hardwired into the brain. So within our brain, there's a battle taking place between negative and positive inherited patterns of behaviour, inherited instinctive patterns of behaviour. And sometimes we can see this reflected, even today, so that within our safe and known local group, we can practice and exhibit the positive qualities, sociability, empathy, generosity, and so on. But outside our group, outside our known and local group, towards other groups who we see as unknown, maybe to feared, we can be lethally violent. Even our recent history is littered with examples of this. We can think of the demise of Yugoslavia and what happened there in different parts of Yugoslavia and so on. So in evolutionary terms, we inherit positive and negative instinctive mental tendencies that are there within the brain. We can think of this, in Buddhist terms, that we have within us a Buddha nature or a Buddha capacity. This is our capacity for good patterns of behaviour. But we also have a Mara nature or a Mara capacity. All of the negative inherited instinctive mental patterns are there as well. So remember that within us we have the capacity for good and we have the capacity for evil. We have the capacity for positive behaviour, we have the capacity for negative behaviour. And this brings me then to the next level of conditionality, the volitional mental order, the kamma or karma niyama level of conditionality. This is the level of moral or ethical choices. Now, I want to emphasise something that I've not brought out so far about the brain. Because in explaining what we inherit in evolutionary terms, in instinctive terms, it might seem that things are quite fixed within the brain. But actually, modern neuroscience has shown that the brain has a tremendous capacity to change itself. It's said that the brain has tremendous flexibility or plasticity. That's the term that's used by scientists, tremendous plasticity of the human brain. So that what we inherit doesn't have to determine our behaviour. There's a capacity for change in the patterning of the brain that's capable of being stimulated from the time we're in the womb right through until the moments before death. No matter how old we are, the brain has the capacity to make and remake itself in remarkable ways. And in particular, because we have self-awareness, we can use our mind to change our brain, to change our mind. We can use our mind to change our brain, to change our mind. Let me try and explain that. What this is saying is that the immaterial experiences of our mind leave behind lasting material traces in the fabric of our brain. What flows through your mind sculpts and shapes and reshapes the working of your brain. So your actions of thought, of speech, and of body matter not just for the present moment, but matter also for the lasting residue such actions leave behind, woven into the fabric of the brain. So if you imagine how spring showers of rain lead to water flowing down the sides of hills, you can imagine how over time these water flows lead to a deepening of gullies and the appearance of settled streams and so on. Water tends to run then in predetermined ways. In the same way, within the brain, if you use particular circuits, particular neural circuits a lot, they become more sensitive to stimulation. They attract more blood flow, more glucose, more oxygen. And in this way, existing connections and existing patterns within the brain get stronger and new connections form. And older connections can weaken through not being used. What you can actually see sometimes is how, through this process, some parts of the brain get noticeably and measurably thicker. I can't remember which part of the brain it is, but it's said that London taxi drivers, because they have to learn so much about all the streets and the way that traffic moves through all the streets of London, there's a particular part of their brain that gets thicker than everybody else's brain. So you can see, visibly see and observe changes in the brain. So we can literally use our mind to sculpt and change our brain, and that therefore helps to change our mind. if you like, this is karma in action. This is karma is observable in the human brain. Actions leave physical residues behind that then can condition further actions. This is karma, action, and the results of karma, karma vipaka. And for those of you who know a little bit about the Yogacara form of Buddhism, we can relate this description to the Yogacara description of the Alaya Vijnana, what they call the storehouse of consciousness, where it said seeds are left by our past actions and which can come to fruition in the future. And this storehouse consciousness, this Alaya Vijnana, is always in dialogue with the other forms of consciousness and awareness. And this storehouse consciousness can include some very deep-seated patterns or dispositions, some of which we inherit, some of which are there because of early conditioning in our life. Okay so far? All right. So, I'm aware that I haven't taken yet the next step to look at the fifth level of conditionality, the transcendental order, and I'll come to that shortly. But I want to look now at how we can use Sangharakshita's system of meditation, or as I prefer to call it tonight, Sangharakshita's system of practice, to work with the mind and brain, to work with the niyamas, with the five levels of conditionality, and to move towards enlightenment. So Sangharakshita's system of practice has four elements, or four components. It's a useful way of looking at the whole of Buddhist practice. It's a useful way of bringing together different elements of Buddhist practice into an understandable system. First level is integration. The second level is positive emotion, which is really meaning positive or helpful attitudes, positive intentions. The third level is spiritual death. And the fourth level is spiritual rebirth. And I'm going to try and explain what these different levels involve and apply what they involve to learning about the brain and the evolution of the brain and working on our brain and mind. So first of all, integration. So as humans, we have self-awareness. We have mindfulness. We're different from other beings on this planet. We can be mindful of what is happening now. We can be mindful of a wider context or purpose. And we can be mindful of the effects of our actions. And bringing this together, all these different forms of mindfulness, is known as integration, becoming aware of how we are, of a wider context on the effect of our actions, is known as integration. We can use self-awareness or mindfulness to carefully observe how the first three levels of conditionality, the physical inorganic, the physical organic, and the instinctive mental order, work in our mind and body complex. In particular, we can use mindfulness and awareness to observe the workings of the instinctive mental order. We can see the process that takes place. If we work on meditation, we begin to see every time we have a sense contact, we see something, or we hear something, or we smell something, or we taste something, or we touch something, or a thought arises in the mind, each time we have a sense contact, it's associated with a vedana, a feeling of pleasantness or unpleasantness or neutrality. And that feeling of pleasantness or unpleasantness or neutrality stimulates volitional responses, stimulates actions. Now, because our brain has what I was describing earlier as plasticity, flexibility, because our brain has the ability to change, we can choose through awareness and mindfulness not to be at the mercy of the negative mental inheritance of greed and hatred. We can see these processes at work in our brain and mind because of awareness and mindfulness. And we can therefore choose not to feed these negative instinctive mental patterns. We see them for what they are. We bring into consciousness what was previously unconscious, and we can change it. Or at least we can weaken its power to take us over. So that, moving into the second element of Sangharakshita's system of practice, positive emotion, we can cultivate positive or helpful attitudes and intentions. We can choose to cultivate positive or ethical choices in our behavior. We can choose to engage in positive karma. We engage with the volitional order, mental order of conditionality, to change our minds and brains in a positive way. We can create new positive patterns in our brain and mind, and we can reduce the power of existing negative patterns in our brain and mind. So through awareness, this is what the Buddha did. If you read the Buddha's account of how the mind works, it's all there. He didn't use the terminology of modern neuroscience, how the brain and mind works, but he described something very, very similar. Very similar. So inside meditation, we learn to apply awareness or mindfulness to observe the workings of our mind and brain. And then we apply this skill, not just in meditation, but in all aspects of our life. And we learn that the quality of awareness or mindfulness that we can bring to this process depends very much on the quality of our ethical choices. The more sensitive we are in the ethical choices we make, the more purified becomes our awareness, the greater clarity we have in our awareness and mindfulness. The greater our ethical sensitivity, then the more pure is our awareness. And the more we can see into how our mind and brain works, and the more we are able to change it. So the stages of integration and positive emotion work together through our mind and brain to make us better human beings. Now the Buddha expressed this very simply in the opening verses of the Dhammapada. That's the Buddha saying, aha, at last, I'm going to get quoted. Is that somebody at the door? No, that's okay, we'll leave it, all right. Okay, so the opening verses of the Dhammapada. This is Sangharakshita's translation. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cart wheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. Every thought, every emotion, every intention, every attitude or aspiration shapes our brain, shapes our mind, and shapes how we will experience the world. Every single moment of consciousness is a moment of practice. We are practicing every moment to become ourselves. And if we observe carefully enough in our experience, if we look carefully enough into our experience, we will observe what the scientists observe in the workings of the brain. And that is, we can discover that the self, what we think of as the self, or selfing, is just another set of patterns in experience. It's just another set of patterns in the brain that have had great benefit for survival purposes, a pattern that exists that we continue to privilege over other patterns in the brain, but a pattern of selfing that we don't have to privilege any longer. If we observe our mind with wise awareness, then we can discover that there is no fixed self. Something that might have been needed to encourage our survival in our evolutionary past, we can now let go of. And this is the third stage of Sangharakshita's system of practice. He calls it spiritual death. What this means, we let go of the sense of a fixed self. We let go of attachment to the self. We let go of a limited self, if you like. And what then is left if we can do that? What is this fourth aspect of Sangharakshita's system of practice? Spiritual rebirth. Well, what then is left if we're able to do this? To let go of attachment to the self. What is left is the transcendental order of conditionality, the Dhamma or Dharma Niyama. This is spiritual rebirth. By aligning ourselves with the level of conditionality known as the Karma Niyama, by living ethically, by purifying our awareness, we can open ourselves to a higher level of conditionality, the transcendental order of conditionality. This is the point at which the self-aware individual can make contact with a pattern of conditioned arising that goes beyond or transcends the individual. A process begins to unfold, a process that begins to work through you. It's not you doing it. Something begins to work through you. Maybe it's a process that's been working through the whole of evolution, looking for ways in which it can be expressed, encouraging the emergence of higher levels of conditionality where that's possible. It's not a process, I think Sangharakshita would say, that can be pinned down just with words and concepts. Maybe it's best to regard spiritual rebirth. Maybe it's best to regard the transcendental order of conditionality with a sense of mystery, with a sense of wonder. We can, if we wish, define enlightenment. We can define it as the extinguishing of the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. It could be defined as a fundamental shift in the working of the brain and the mind, and it could be left at that. But enlightenment can also be seen or felt or intuited as something much more, something that emerges with the evolution of a human being into a state of Buddhahood, something that is more meaningful than we can imagine. Now, a materialist, or perhaps a humanist, would accept much of what I have said this evening about evolution, particularly about the evolution of the brain, could accept much of what I said about the first four levels of conditionality, and could accept much of what I've said about integration and positive emotion. They could even accept spiritual death in the sense of a letting go of the sense of a self. I think a materialist or a humanist can go along with all of that. But a materialist or a humanist would probably not accept what I've been saying about this fifth level of conditionality, the transcendental order of conditionality, and probably would not accept what I've been saying about the idea of spiritual rebirth, the fourth element of Sangharakshita's system of practice. Sangharakshita's Buddhism is not limited by a humanist or a materialist perspective. It goes far beyond that, with a sense of mystery, a sense of wonder, a sense of faith at what might be experienced as we step beyond the received limitations of evolution of the human brain to something unknown, to something unimaginably creative.